and is in listen-only mode.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the Board of Public Works. The state of Maryland has now administered nearly 5 million COVID-19 vaccines. We've vaccinated 85% of all Marylanders over the age of 65, and more than 62% of all Marylanders 18 years and older. We're well on our way to reaching the 70% of all adults vaccinated that the president talked about, well in advance of the goal set by President Biden. Maryland has been recognized by the Biden administration and the New England Journal of Medicine, among others, as a national leader on vaccine equity. And all of this progress has put us in a new phase of our vaccination effort, where we are focused now on making sure that no arm is left behind. On Monday, we announced a new financial incentive program for state employees to get the COVID-19 vaccine. And I'm strongly encouraging businesses across the state to offer similar incentives. Yesterday, I announced that we have activated state mobile vaccination teams to conduct additional clinics at Maryland nursing homes, and we're providing $12 million in new funding to support community-based vaccination initiatives led by hospitals to work with local community partners. Today, I'll be at the Ripken Stadium mass vaccination site in Harford County with Cal Ripken. And I'm pleased to report that walk-up, no-appointment vaccinations have now expanded to all 13 of the state's mass vaccination sites. So you can now walk up or drive through at any one of these sites without an appointment, and you can immediately get your shot. It's never been easier to find and to get a vaccine. And I just want to take a moment to thank our team of more than 11,400 people that have been helping us to get more shots into the arms of more Marylanders so that we can put this pandemic behind us once and for all, and we can get back to normal. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues for any opening remarks. Madam Treasurer.
Governor, as first off, that's great news. I know, and I can only say how great it feels to after you've taken the shot with all the trepidation and everything, to know that you've done your part and you've helped your family and the people around you, and it's just a very good thing to do. Beyond that, as I said before we started, Governor and Comptroller, I seem to have done something with my computer, so I am now on my iPad. So if it looks like I'm looking in a strange direction or all of a sudden disappear, please know electronics was not my number one discipline in school. But it's good to be here, and it's good to get a sense that things are moving forward. And with that, I'll turn over to the Comptroller.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer, Madam and Mr. Governor. Thank you for that update on the vaccinations. I love the slogan, no arm left behind. And I know there's some hesitation out there among people because of just misinformation they receive. So hats off to you and Cal Ripken and others who are doing the right thing. And I couldn't agree with you more that we're in a race right now, as folks say, between getting people vaccinated and Mother Nature coming up with some curveball. So hats off to you, Governor.
Don't forget to take a baseball with you, by the way, Governor, or two or three,
yeah,
just in case.
No question. I think people are very excited to see Cal today. They're tired of seeing me at these sites, but that's a pretty big deal.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you. But on the other hand, if someone's going to sign that ball, make it Cal.
Might as well be the Iron Man. Yeah.
So I did want to mention the fact that on Sunday I saw 60 Minutes, and there was a segment about the current global shortage of microchips, and that it's impacting a lot of industries in the United States. And frankly, I hear it a lot from folks like automobile dealers and others in Maryland who say everything from car manufacturing to smartphones to ventilators are affected by the shortage of chips. 60 Minutes highlighted that the pandemic has really glaringly exposed the vulnerabilities, I guess you would call it, that our global supply chain have. Many U.S. companies are now facing a shortage of microchips, which are primarily manufactured in Asia, apparently, known to me, and other necessary components for their products. Our auto manufacturers have had to slow production as a result of this dynamic, and these supply shortages are contributing to inflation throughout the economy today. I believe Ford has almost a million cars parked waiting for chips because they're completely constructed, but put together, but they can't go anywhere without the chips. And they're not a small number of chips in a car, apparently. So the 60 Minutes piece said that 25 years ago, the United States produced 37% of the world's semiconductor manufacturing. Today, we're only at 12%. We've gone from 37% to 12% of the world supply. I mention this because the segment served as a recent example of the American economy's current dependence on foreign manufacturing after years of offshoring. And we see the impact across our state here in Maryland. Maryland was once one of the crown jewels of American manufacturing, with a number of Maryland cities like Dundalk serving as very productive manufacturing hubs for companies like General Motors, Bethlehem Steel, and Crown Cork and Seal, and Martin Marietta. Maryland has lost over 50% of its manufacturing jobs just in the last 25 years. And we see that impact in our greatest city, frankly. You can't be a great state if you don't have a great city like Baltimore City. But the decline has been precipitous. We had 950,000 people in 1950. We now have 600,000 people in Baltimore City. And it's why I think President Biden's agenda, which I know the governor was involved in, which President Biden outlined last week in his first joint address to Congress, to spur American manufacturing and innovation through his American Families Plan, obviously that's absolutely critical. And as we in Maryland begin to chart the course for our economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, now's the right time to reimagine and reinvent ourselves as to what the future Maryland economy might look like, especially when it comes to manufacturing and especially when it comes to chips. And I wouldn't know one chip from another, but I'm pretty confident that...
you know the difference between potato chips and chocolate chips.
Yeah, I get that. I'm not the expert, but there are experts. And obviously there are experts, a lot of them in Maryland. And we also have strong economic bones in Maryland. So I applaud President Biden for his commitment to making the United States a global leader in manufacturing, particularly as it relates to green energy infrastructure, which is another item for where Maryland's taken some leadership. And I hope there'll be a bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill. I know everyone knows that there's a strong bipartisan tradition and process in Maryland, and I know that exists. We have assets like the Port of Baltimore, owned by the state, BWI Marshall Airport, owned by the state, our highly skilled workforce, the growing demand for manufacturing jobs. And I happen to think that we're uniquely suited to be a future home to a manufacturing site or something else, maybe a research center, and something that's involved with companies seeking to invest in their domestic supply chains. We can partner with our unions and other community partners to present a comprehensive vision for how Maryland can reestablish its manufacturing sector. I'm not suggesting we don't have efforts underway, obviously, but I'm talking about a real leap into the future, something that benefits our workers and our small businesses. This is not just big tech companies. Aligns with our mass transit investments, supports other strategic priorities for our state, such as powering our electricity grid with 100% clean energy produced here in the state of Maryland. So I just want to say publicly, Governor, you and President Biden, who I know you all are trying to work together with Maryland's congressional team, thank you for promoting policies to revitalize our manufacturing industry. And I'll just say for folks who say, isn't this just a lot of rhetoric about the future? No. today in the Washington Post, there's an announcement about Montgomery County working with a corporate nonprofit from the private sector and the state of Maryland and the county. Mark Elrich announced that they are putting $500,000 from Montgomery County into a joint effort to develop something called Connected DMV. That's the nonprofit. Basically set up a state-of-the-art pandemic protection center funded by the federal government, the private sector, and local government. That's going to be a significant facility near NIH and near FDA. This is not some kind of poppycock or something. This is like a big effort that can result in something. And I suggested in Baltimore City, we might want to focus together on something that would be at Sparrows Point or Trade Point Atlantic or somewhere up there, but either a big research center partnering with the federal government or in the private sector, or some kind of manufacturing facility. There are only three companies in the world that make chips. Why don't we make a fourth one in Baltimore? And anyway, I bring that to you not as anything other than I hope that we can continue to work together in the great state of Maryland and take advantage of the pandemic to learn lessons like they're doing with this Montgomery County facility, which I think is going to be a big deal. Well, maybe we could do something tangent with them. And I'm at your disposal, and obviously the lead of the legislature has got things underway that they want to do also. I'm just suggesting there's some real potential there. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Comptroller. I agree with a lot of what you just said, and you're right. For a couple of decades, we were losing manufacturing jobs at a pretty substantial rate, and it was devastating to our economy and all the places that you talked about and people. But we've had a real resurgence over the last 6 years, breaking records on adding manufacturing jobs in Maryland at twice the national average and at one of the fastest rates of any state in America. So I'd love to work with you on any ideas for bringing chip manufacturers into the state. But you know, I'm very proud of the fact that manufacturing, particularly advanced manufacturing, we've made incredible strides, and there have been a lot of people working hard. Many of our things, like the More Jobs for Marylanders Act and some of the incentives, selling people on why the Port of Baltimore and BWI Airport and our skilled workforce and all that. We've been making progress, but there's no question we can do more, and we look forward to working with you.
Excellent.
With that, I guess we'll get started with the Secretary's agenda.
Maybe, yeah. Morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. There are 15 items on the Secretary's agenda this morning and 12 reports of emergency procurements. I'm happy to assist with answering any questions.
Thank you. Any questions on the Secretary's agenda?
I don't have a problem with items A1 through A7 on the agenda. They are reports of emergency procurement that are being presented to the Board of Public Works for review. I'm not going to go through each one in the interest of time. And frankly, I don't have an objection to any of them substantively. But each of these contracts, A1 through A7, deal with our state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And there's obviously no disagreement about the need for the services. What I continue to have an ongoing problem with is, as I expressed at the last Board of Public Works meeting, and over the last year, is the timeliness of these emergency reports being submitted to the board. Secretary Gontram, if I'm not mistaken, you reported to my staff that over the last year, 46 emergency contracts have been submitted to the board late after the 45-day deadline. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So here we have, and this is not a matter of the substance or getting in the way or doing some kind of cumbersome procurement process. I'm talking about 46 emergency contracts representing hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money could not be given to us within 45 days for some reason. Today, we're seeing in this group, A1 through 7, a $19 million contract for COVID lab tests. being brought before the board 12 months late. After the initial contract is now expired, on the same agenda, we're seeing a $5.4 million emergency modification to the same contract that the department already entered into, and to add another 8 months to the base term. We're seeing four emergency modifications to a lease agreement costing more than $5.6 million that were executed last June, last September, last October, and last December, and are just now being presented to us months after they occurred. And over the last year, in the last several months especially, we've seen a parade of emergency contracts that have been brought before this board months after the 45-day deadline. And of course, by the time the board has a chance to review it, the agencies are months into the emergency contract terms. Any board action to nullify or remand them would be disruptive. Time and again, we've heard the same excuse recycled. We're in an emergency. We're in an emergency. That's why we didn't fax you the three-page document that is required by statute and by COMAR. But we're more than a year into this emergency now, and there's simply no excuse, in my opinion, none whatsoever, for agencies to be skirting procurement laws and regulations and denying this board the opportunity to fulfill its statutory obligation to provide oversight. And furthermore, I would argue that the board's oversight role is actually all the more important because of the emergency. Because we're in an emergency crisis, Governor, billions of dollars are being expended at a rapid pace, and each of us on this board as fiduciaries of the state's treasury have a legal responsibility to make sure that taxpayers' dollars are being spent wisely and appropriately. And it frankly doesn't really matter to me whether it's federal dollars or state dollars. They all end up in the state's treasury. We're all responsible for its stewardship. I believe the chief procurement officer of the state, Bob Gleason, is on the call. Could I ask him a couple of quick questions if he's there? Mr. Secretary, is he here?
Yes, he is here. Mr. Gleason?
Excellent. Mr. Gleason, welcome. Good morning. As you know, thanks to Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford's leadership and vision, the state and the governors, state underwent a significant, and the legislature, the state underwent a significant reorganization in our procurement structure. And part of the justification for the restructuring was to make our procurement process more efficient and agencies more compliant with procurement regulations and laws. So if you could, give me your take on the current situation that we find ourselves in. Apparently, the General Assembly found it alarming enough to enact pieces of legislation recently to scale back emergency procurement authority, which is given to the agencies. What is your slant, please?
Well, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I don't know that I have a slant, but I would say that...
What's your take? I mean, it's... We're talking 176 emergency procurements, 46 of which have been... beyond the 45-day period. My understanding is literally we're talking about faxing a three-page document to the Board of Public Works. What is it that prevents the agencies from, at least for the 46 I'm referring to, be up to a year late?
Well, I'd have to look at each individual one. There might be different circumstances. But in total, in summary, I agree. Our process should be better. I don't know why they can't be, and again, I'd have to look at each of the agency's transactions to see what happened and when in order to understand that. But I would say it, from an overall view, we had not completely transformed in enough time. We had only maybe 9 to 10 months to sort of go through this process of amalgamating four different agencies into one. We had not fully completed all of our transformation in terms of our processes, our professional workforce. So we're still in the process of transformation, and this is maybe a symptom of some of that effort before COVID hit us. COVID hit us only 6 to 9 months into our transformation, and we had not completed that. And I would also add that we were in the middle of our e-procurement transformation from Periscope to Emma, and we did not get additional budget or personnel to go through this transformation. We were pulling this out of our skin to create an entirely new organization. So part of this is symptomatic of that effort. And again, we were going hand to mouth. And once the pandemic hit, we were searching, back to your point about the economy, infrastructure, manufacturing, a lot of that was outsourced over the last 20 years to other countries. And we had to go out and grab that stuff before other jurisdictions got it. So yes, we had reports to do, but I would also suggest that during the emergency, we were also trying to find materials, goods, set up alternate care sites, hospitals, build a workforce of healthcare workers. So there was a lot going on, and I would just provide some context with regards to that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I appreciate all that, and I understand the governor is very focused on not fumbling the ball on the five-yard line. I'm not suggesting that's part of this. This is all about, statutory rule that we need to get this stuff.
Well, could I interrupt for a second?
Thank you, Madam Treasurer.
I'm trying not to because of this strange iPad situation. But one of the problems was, actually, Mr. Gleason, I just heard you say, well, and we had so much to do, and everyone knows how much you have to do and how under-resourced you are, that we didn't have time for some reports. And I think, to me, that's an indication. This is not just some report. This is the way we assure transparency and a good procurement process. And I'm afraid that in not just with you all and DGS, but across the departments, people see this as one more report. It's not that. And the question is, what are we going to do to make sure people understand this report is the citizens' port? I mean, through this report, they know where their money's going. And I'm with the comptroller on this. I just don't understand why you can't just fax something over saying, today I'm doing this, or last week we did this. If it's something about the form, whatever it is, we should fix it, because it's not just some report.
Madam Treasurer, I didn't mean to belittle it in any way, shape, or form, because I too feel I have a fiduciary responsibility to the citizens and all of our agencies to make sure that they do the right thing, and to the Board of Public Works. So I would like to come back and offer perhaps a better answer. I'm not prepared to address each of the individual reports or what they were. I was given context from an overall perspective, but certainly we always need to do a better job, and I recognize the importance of this.
Well, okay.
One of the solutions might be technology. I suggested this before as well. Transparency is very important in public procurement, because that's where trust lives. So I'm very conscious of this, and we're working certainly with the Secretary Gontram to ensure that our PAR reports are going to be in the technology solutions and some of the other reporting mechanisms. But it's a journey that we're on. I'd like to get there tomorrow. And maybe we'll get there tomorrow, but it might be a little bit.
2 weeks from now is okay, too.
I want to just associate myself with the treasurer, and I'm sure the governor also believes this. This is not burning the substance of
what I'm sure Mr. Gleason does also.
Look, let me just jump in and say that I agree with the need to have complete transparency, and it's unfortunate that 46 out of these 176 did not get done on time. And not to make excuses for any of the folks on the team at DGS or at Department of Health, but I mean, we did. This has only happened once before, more than 100 years ago, and we did more emergency contracts probably over a several month period than we did in the past 50 years added together. And people were working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they were and trying to procure desperately needed supplies that were going to keep people alive. And frankly, did they drop the ball because they didn't stop what they were doing to fill out some paperwork, important paperwork? Yes, they did. But, I think they would argue that they just didn't have time to do it, but they are catching up. And many of these things were from back in last spring, in the middle of the worst part of the crisis, when we were starting from nothing and building an entire infrastructure to do 10 million tests. And now they're still busy. They haven't ever caught up and caught their breath from that. So I agree with all the comments about we have to do better. And I think everybody on the team at every agency agrees with that. But I just want you to know what kind of pressure they were all under and how important the mission was. And yes, we've got to go back and do better and get this caught up.
Great. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I'd like to hear from you, Mr. Gleason, in 2 weeks as to how we're correcting it. It's not rocket science. It's your leadership. You say to the agencies, if this isn't, if you have to wait a year to alert the Board of Public Works about an emergency procurement, you're not going to be working on procurements too much longer after that. The law says 45 days, and it is simply inexcusable at this point to be getting a year and more into this thing, to have these agencies, as the treasurer said, treat these things as a low priority. This is not a report. She's absolutely right. And this is not something that will take people away from essential work. It takes 10 minutes to fax the Board of Public Works, Secretary Gontram sitting there. And please correct it immediately. This is not something that I'm buying your argument that there were so many important things that we're doing and we were saving people's lives and getting tested.
You don't believe that?
I do believe that you're doing that, but I do not believe that it concerns the timing of these very important reports.
I would disagree.
If you're in charge of it, I hope that you will fix it come 2 weeks, because it's unacceptable. And
Mr. Comptroller, I hear you, and we're going to work on it.
Just finish. I'll just include, Governor, if I could. You know, once again, it's the timing of sending us an alert that you're doing this. It is not the substance. And please correct it, because it's a significant threat to the authority of the board if it's allowed to just kind of be kicked down the highway a little bit. So please, Mr. Gleason, if you could come up with the correction for this, I would be grateful. Many of these are now approaching 10, 11, 12 months lateness. That's wrong. And needs to be corrected. It can be. And thank you very much, Governor.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on the Secretary's agenda, or is there a motion?
I have one question. I'm trying to remember what items they were, but Morgan State University, they're two great projects. Two things that I think people should know are happening to approach the deferred maintenance problems that the university has. And it's I don't want to be just known as the good news treasurer, but this is very good news. And I would like to hear just very, very briefly about the role that you are proposing that you and the other parts of government coming together through the MOU will play. All my notes are gone. I apologize, Mr. President, but it was a pretty great step forward, I think.
Morgan State University President Dr. Wilson is in attendance this morning.
Let's hear from Dr. Wilson.
And the Clean Energy Center, that's the other agency. Sorry.
Okay. Good morning. I assume I'm up. Governor Hogan, Comptroller of Francho, Treasurer Kopp. It is always a pleasure to come before you and address the Board of Public Works. We first of all want to thank Governor Hogan for including the additional appropriation to Morgan State University that he included this year in the operating budget. And of course, we want to thank the General Assembly for supporting that. And we want to also thank the General Assembly, the governor, and others for bringing to an end the long-running HBCU lawsuit in the state, and are looking forward to receiving those investments in order to further enhance Morgan State University. We are in a period of immense growth and momentum here at Morgan, and we want to continue that. The state officially designated us in 2016 as the state of Maryland's, quote, preeminent public urban research university. We're taking that very, very seriously, and COVID-19 has revealed why we need to take that seriously, given all of the economic disparities, health disparities that we see in Baltimore City and other urban areas. Morgan is poised to fill that space. And I said in the Baltimore Sun this morning that I can so clearly see that in 2030, we should be to the city of Baltimore what universities like the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is to Milwaukee, what Wayne State University is to Detroit, what Georgia State University is to Atlanta, what Temple University is to Philadelphia. The city of Baltimore right now has only one comprehensive doctoral granting research university, public, and that is Morgan. And so we think that the future growth, vitality, sustainability of Baltimore City lies significantly in the progression and mobility, upward mobility of Morgan State University. And so I appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments. We do have a couple of agenda items this morning, and I have colleagues here who are ready to respond to any questions you have about those agenda items. Those agenda items are in alignment with our push at Morgan for a campus that is sustainable. We are paying a lot of attention to climate issues. We're paying a lot of attention to, you know, how we reduce the carbon footprint. We have three buildings on campus that are LEED certified gold, and we are positioning Morgan to hopefully win one of the federal climate science centers that President Biden has indicated that he wants to have on about 15 university campuses, including one on an HBCU campus. And we think Morgan is more poised to actually win one of these federal significantly resourced centers in climate science than any other institution in the nation. The items that we have in front of you today is extending our theme here of sustainability, and we certainly hope that you will approve them. And if you have any questions, Mr. Sidney Evans, Kim McCalla, David Lachina are here to address your questions.
Thank you very much, Doctor, and thank you for your leadership. Greatly appreciate you joining us this morning. Did you guys have any detailed questions on the items at Morgan?
Could we just hear maybe 3 minutes on this relationship between the Maryland Clean Energy Center and the university, and also whether it could be a model for relationship between the center and other components of the state?
Sure, Madam Treasurer. This is Sidney, Sidney Evans. Good morning, Governor Hogan, Comptroller Franchot, and Madam Kopp. The university entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Maryland Clean Energy Center to create a partnership to develop a comprehensive energy plan, which provides a holistic, comprehensive methodology of planning for the current and future energy needs of the campus, as opposed to a single approach to fixing inefficient and broken systems. And Madam Treasurer, as you and I have talked with Dr. Wilson and your staff, deferred maintenance is a real cancer for any university, and specifically at Morgan. And with the great support we received from the governor and the legislature on the capital budget, we want to find the proper balance between building new buildings and maintaining and fixing old buildings. Energy management is a strategy where we can meet deferred maintenance needs, but also there are financing opportunities through energy performance contracts to meet these needs. Treasurer Cobb, you're absolutely right. We believe this can be a new model that is sustainable between the Maryland Clean Energy Center and Morgan and other universities. We at Morgan have a very talented construction design management team led by Ms. Kim McCallum, but we can't do everything. And the Maryland Clean Energy Center brings another set of skills to the table with their expertise in energy management and sustainability. This is a great partnership. In addition, the partnership has to be a three-legged stool. Morgan being one leg, Maryland Clean Energy Center being another leg, and you need a subject matter expert in terms of a global energy company. And we went through a very comprehensive procurement process with the Maryland Clean Energy Center, led by their procurement director. We started with 9 companies, narrowed it down to 3, and fortunately, we were able to select the Siemens Corporation. So now we have this three-legged stool partnership with Maryland Clean Energy Center, Morgan, and Siemens, and we are moving forward with 5 tasks to address a long-term energy strategy. So with that, hopefully that's an overview, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Well, thank you. I don't want to take everyone's time. I look forward to learning more about it. But I would just like to say, both to the governor and the comptroller, I think this is the type of public-private partnership where you really, everyone leverages off of everyone else. I see the comptroller smile, and I know what he's thinking about, but this is a great example of how we bring everybody together and use their strengths through synergy to make the whole stronger even than the parts. And I hope as we all go forward in different roles, whatever we're doing, that this sort of model we can use in many different instances. And I'm not surprised that our official state urban research university is one of the first to step out this way. So we look forward to seeing how it worked out, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you very much, Treasurer Cobb.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
Could we possibly have it after Treasurer Cobb when you build it, and or at least part of it? Because she is the state's leading advocate for saving the planet. And thank you, Madam Treasurer, for bringing it all the time.
There are millions of people in our state who are strong advocates for saving the planet. But I thank you.
There's only
and we
one
appreciate thing. The advocacy.
Could I just ask, closing, President Wilson, could you, after you save the planet, and I completely agree with you about the pivotal importance of what you're describing to us, could you also turn your attention to the global shortage of microchips, how that is impacting a lot of industries, and why should we do something special at Morgan in conjunction with the Greater Baltimore Committee and the leadership of the City of Baltimore and the State of Maryland? Something really significant where we rally scientists and policy makers all over the world to help us figure out this chip thing. And the governor, I said, it was not Utz potato chips. It is the critical components. And I just think that the headquarters for Maryland's contribution to this could be through Morgan, federally funded. somewhat similar to kind of the climate issue you just described and the issue that I described about the pandemic preparation center that's going to be, I think, located in Montgomery County. I mean, why don't we take advantage of Morgan? And if you guys could think it through a little bit and flesh it out, it's a regional thing, a national thing. It's a global thing, really, but it's there. Why not in Baltimore? That's what I say.
And that's what I say as well. We accept the challenge. We will be bringing in national scientists. As a matter of fact, I have a cabinet meeting going on right now where we're talking about that. Individuals from corporate labs, individuals from federal labs, to identify the three or four peaks of excellence that we are going to be known for here at Morgan by 2030. And this is certainly a space where we need to move aggressively into. And so Comptroller Franco, Governor Hogan, Secretary Cobb, we accept this challenge and we would look forward to working hand in glove with the state, with our regional partners, in order to ensure that a federal center of this type is anchored here at Morgan with a global reach.
Thank you.
I would move approval if that's appropriate of the agenda.
It's appropriate. Is there a second?
Second.
Very good. 3-0. Thank you. We will move on to the DNR real property agenda.
Hi, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 5 items on our real property agenda today. And Governor, I would just like to take a second to thank you again for recognizing 2 of the Baltimore area's great outdoor recreation organizations yesterday. We really appreciate you helping to highlight the importance of outdoor rec to our state and our youth.
Well, thank you, Madam Secretary. It was a couple of great programs, and I really appreciate you bringing them to my attention and inviting me to come out and see some wonderful work being done by a couple of terrific organizations. So thank you so much. Are there questions on the DNR agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. 3-0.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to the university system.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Tom Hickey, representing University System of Maryland. We have 2 items today for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions on the university system? Is there a motion?
I just wanted to ask, perhaps Tom's the right person to ask, could you just speak briefly about the recent announcement by the system to require mandating students, faculty, and staff to be vaccinated before returning to campus this fall? I just want to applaud the system for doing that and university presidents for the decision. It's got to be generating some flack from people that have been misinformed and might think this is heavy-handed or unnecessary. But maybe you could explain a few details of the mandate, how it will be enforced, will institutions be offering vaccines for students, faculty, and staff? What do the exemptions look like? What happens to students, faculty, and staff who refuse to comply? And by the way, I could read off the dozen vaccinations that are required of every K through 12 public school student. Long, long list of mandatory vaccines. So if this is not like uncharted territory. And
Thank you for those questions. Those are questions that we are all working through. Since the pandemic began, there's been a work group that the chancellor and the regents have convened that consists of public health experts, medical experts. We have shared governance with the cabinets and the faculty at all of our institutions. And they are the ones who actually, the regents authorized the chancellor to make a determination about the vaccination mandate. And working with this group, they determined that it's in the best interest of everyone to have all of our faculty, students, and staff fully vaccinated for this fall. The state of Maryland, with the governor's leadership, actually designated a day for higher education at the mass vaccination site at M&T Bank Stadium for higher education staff and employees and students. The students welcomed this overwhelmingly. The student councils have weighed in on this. So this is something that has the full support of the campus communities. There are a number of questions. The questions you raise, I'm sorry I can't answer them today, but those are questions that this group is working on, and there's going to be a full communication to all the families and students about how this is going to work. But I suspect it's going to be how it was for last fall semester, when all university system campuses required a negative COVID test before returning to campus. So there's going to be some type of, proof that you've been vaccinated. And of course, we're going to have to protect the personal privacy of the students' health information and all of that. But those are all questions that we're working for forward with. And I also want to, when the chancellor announced this on April 23rd, I wanted to point out that, going into this fall semester, it was a very dicey situation, having, folks on campus, living on campus in close quarters. And the chancellor gave a full credit to the students who took this very seriously. And we actually had, our college campuses were some of the safest places to be in the state of Maryland, less than 1% positivity rate throughout the system. And that's a testament to the students taking this very seriously and not flouting the rules. So I really want to thank our students for taking it seriously.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you. Is there a motion on the university system?
Move approval.
Second.
Thank you very much. The vote is 3-1. Let's move on to the Department of Transportation. I believe we have Sean Powell, our Deputy Secretary of Operations. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Sean Powell, Deputy Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation. Secretary Slater did ask that I pass along his regrets for not being available today. He's paying his last respects to a family member. The Maryland Department of Transportation has 10 items for your consideration, and we do have representatives available to answer any questions. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, sir.
Thank you, Sean. Are there any questions on the transportation agenda? Hearing none, is there a motion?
No, except I would just like to point out there was another great article about, I seem to be good news today, about the Howard Street Tunnel and its importance to the economy of the state. And I think it's just great that people are finding out about it. Couldn't be more important.
No, well, thank you. I didn't see the article today, but we're very excited about the fact that we're making progress on the Howard Street Tunnel, and I'm looking forward to this summer getting out there and actually starting the construction. So it's going to be a huge economic development driver, and it's going to dramatically increase the production of the port and put thousands of people to work. So we're excited about that.
It hasn't happened in the recent past, so hats off to MDOT Secretary and Mr. Powell, Secretary, and the governor and the legislature, because, finally it gets done.
Well, it's not done, but at least we're finally getting started.
We've been working on it a long time.
Started is very good.
Governor, yeah. Thank you for your persistence on this. This has been on your agenda for quite a long time.
We had it all done in 2015, I guess, and CSX pulled out the last minute. We lost all the federal funding and state funding. We had to rebuild it. It's like putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, but we never gave up, and it was a great team of people working together on it. So thank you. And is there a motion on this transportation?
Move approval.
Second.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Powell. Vote is 3-0. We're going to move on to the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Maryland Department of General Services. We are presenting 51 items for your consideration today. Of note, half of our items are, or nearly half, are CGLs, administrating capital funds across the state. We have representatives available to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I just want to start by highlighting one of the items that I think is important, and I want to thank everybody for. It's item 5, which is the $300,000 grant for the defenders of the First Amendment Memorial. And the memorial is under construction just down the street here at Newman Park to honor the 5 Capitol Gazette staff members who tragically lost their lives on June 28th, 2018. Last year, I was proud to proclaim June 28th, Freedom of the Press Day, and to recognize the vital role that freedom of the press has in our democracy and our duty to honor and protect this fundamental constitutional right. So I thank everybody for being involved. This is a great grant. We're happy to see the memorial being constructed. Are there any other questions on DGS?
I just want to second that because, you know, this is not happening in a vacuum. We've seen a four-year assault on the press as somehow enemies of the people. I mean, what a bunch of nonsense. And it breeds this kind of, unfortunately, deranged behavior. So, yes, I salute the governor and the legislature, or whoever came up with the $300,000, and the people at the Gazette. I mean, what a tragedy that was. But why would it surprise any of us after the absolute just swamp of nasty misinformation about reporters? And obviously, this assault on the press, individual journalists, profession as a whole, I just hope we can begin to heal. It's a very, very dangerous trend. It's something autocrats do all around the world. They attack members of the press who try to tell the truth. The press is not always accurate. I complain a lot. My own personal coverage, that's okay. But they're truth seekers. It's not even the rule of law. It's just what is true and what isn't. And I'll just conclude by saying, Governor, I know you speak out on the conspiracy stuff that unfortunately is out there. Thank you. Because, you know, I'm a Democrat. I speak out and people say, well, it's just because he's partisan. No. It's something basic to our country's future. And we need to protect and defend journalistic freedom. And obviously remember the unbelievable tragedy of every person that we lost at the Capitol Gazette. So,
Yeah, thank you. I'll never forget that day. I was in a meeting in my office when the state troopers interrupted to say that this shooting was taking place at the Capitol. And I rushed to the scene, was there right away and providing all the assistance and working together with all of our law enforcement heroes that were there to save some of the other folks' lives. But it was a tragedy that we will never forget. And that's why I think this memorial is so important. Yeah, thank you. Are there any other questions on the DGS agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Very good. The vote is 3-0. That was a very efficient meeting. And I just close by saying the treasurer talked about the partnerships. And we had the president of Morgan talk about the three-legged stool, I think, the stool. And I think this is a perfect example of that partnership working together and the three-legged stool. So I want to thank my partners, as usual, for coming together. And thank you for everything that you do. That concludes the Board of Public Works. Thank you.
Thanks to iPad. Thank you.
iPad worked.